Greetings, every soul. This is Christopher Rudy for Cosmic Love, and it's my great pleasure today to interview Dr. Maurice Termal, affectionately called Dr. Mo by his clients and friends. Maurice is the author of Conscious Evolution, Preparing for Ascension 2012, and also The Voice, A Mythological Guide to Light Worker Service. He has three university degrees, including a PhD in counseling psychology. Dr. Mo has also written and recorded three CD compilations of rock and blues spiritual growth music. His latest CD is titled Now is the Time. It features 12 soul-inspiring songs and is doing quite well in the charts at DjangoAirplay.com. You can go to Dr. Mo's website at www.nolosthope.com. So if you put in nolosthope.com, www before that, or http://, you'll be good to go. Anyway, Maurice has always been fascinated by the stories and life lessons illustrated in mythology, mankind's oldest and most universal teaching tool. For him, mythology is the foundation of today's psychology, whose purpose is conscious evolution. The father of modern psychology, Carl Jung, pioneered understanding of the collective unconscious that myths represent. Jung's only book written for the layman, Man and His Symbols, framed understanding of those first principles for conscious evolution revealed in archetypes, a core pattern of common principles that represent a universally common pattern for, you might say, the common sense of how the constitution of conscious evolution throughout history has been framed by the same archetypal myths, ceremonial rituals, governing structures, and virtually all other cultural constructs whereby perception is reality. So there's four basic archetypes Jung refers to. We know them in different forms, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and physically. The fire, air, water, and earth are the four winds of the native cultures referred to. And spiritually, we are what we believe, having become what we believed. Mentally, we are what we think, having become what we thought. Emotionally, we are what we feel, having become what we felt. And physically, we are what we do, having become what we did. So a longtime fan of Joseph Campbell, who's the author of The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Maurice has incorporated these views into his work as a therapist, a researcher, and a spiritual teacher. What better source of vital information can there be for a living mythology which inspires our conscious evolution? Mythmaster Joseph Campbell gave a series of six exceptional interviews with Bill Moyers on PBS at George Lucas's Star Wars ranch back in 1988. And this series is called The Power of Myth and is available on Netflix with either instant downstreaming or DVD rental. I reference this because we'll be talking with Maurice here in a moment about The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which he included in his doctoral thesis. And I want to give a little quote here by Joseph Campbell, where he says, "I say, follow your bliss and do not be afraid, and doors will open where you did not know they were going to be." This bliss of the hero's path is portrayed in mythology in a thousand ways. As a living contemporary of Joseph Campbell, Maurice Termal has carried the torch to the present. The divine spark that burns this everlasting torch is the Holy Spirit of archetypal love and action, you might say, in one way or the other. Connection with this wholeness or holiness has always been the source of inspiration for mystics, shamans, saints, and masters for holistic healing of body, mind, and spirit throughout history. To know the archetypes of wholeness is to know thyself, the beginning of self-mastery as anciently recommended by the philosopher Socrates. The more conscientious the disciplines for conscious evolution, the greater the results. Shift happens. That's shift. Such discipline for true disciples on the path of self-mastery ultimately involves and evolves our individual and collective conscience, an awareness of how we process the stream of consciousness moment to moment. Obviously, we are as we become more conscious of how we are individually and collectively conscious, the shift, conscious evolution, kicks in. A process of self-correcting, self-elevation for salvation becomes self-evident as we engage the creative learning process at the heart of conscious evolution. Today, Maurice views himself as a light worker, here to serve mankind on its quest for wholeness. His novel, The Voice, tells a story of aspiring light workers learning to connect with Source. His nonfiction work, Conscious Evolution, delivers the foundational background for this form of seeking and the necessary psychological steps needed to secure that all-important connection. Quite simply, the only way to get ahead of the accelerating rate of change, and thereby make it slow down in a relative sense, is for light workers, light weavers, and light bearers to speed up our awakening with more light as the spirit that matters now. Good psychology is just a mental guide for the conscious evolution of spirituality. And just as the future is the incarnation of our beliefs, thoughts, feelings, and actions from the past, so does conscious evolution compel incarnation of the light of creation, the source, or however you ultimately conceive the holy compassion at the heart of the mind of God. Dr. Maurice Termal is the incarnation of this message, and that we are here to learn these lessons, and that we must consciously choose to reconnect with Source or be left behind when 2012 delivers its big wallop, if not before. So let's welcome Maurice Termal to Cosmic Love. Are you there, Doc?
I am here, and wow. Let me tell your audience that I'm responsible for maybe 15 to 20% of that intro. The rest was your host here, Christopher Rudy, who went out and did a PhD thesis on the whole business of mythology and Joseph Campbell.
Well, that subject has enthralled me for a long time. When I got seriously on the path back in 1970, it was Jung's Man and His Symbols that launched me. I just dropped out of school and hitchhiked out to the mystery school at Rosa Croix University out in San Jose and began studying the mysteries of God.
Wow. You were there earlier than I. I was coming up what I would call the self-help ladder, and one of the book that I read back then was I'm Okay, You're Okay, which was the first really psychological book after The Power of Positive Thinking that I had read as a 20-year-old.
I remember that one. That was a good one.
I was reading, while you were doing what you were doing, I was reading stuff like that, Fritz Perls and the people from the Esalen Center, and there's a particular island off the coast of, well, between Vancouver and Vancouver Island. There's an island there where they used to do a lot of that spiritual work, a lot of Eastern influences there. And in the 70s, I attended a big symposium in Toronto where the whole thing was a function of Esalen doing an international tour. So I met some of those characters and, listened to their stuff and slowly got immersed. But I came up the psychological route where what I can see from you is you jumped right into the deep stream of the spiritual and esoteric, and because you're quite well versed in that.
Well, I'm the Man and His Symbols thing really stuck. That did something to me, and actually I had a series of visions that wasn't unlike his Jung's mandalic visions when he came out of his really deep stuff. And mine was the geometrically ordered divinity, and God as geometrically ordered divinity, and the frames of reference with the law of the one, the circle, the two and one, the cross, the three and one, the trinity, the four and one, with the archetypal cosmic cube, city four square, New Jerusalem, mandalic, Hopi, Tibetan sand paintings, you know how they're, you know.
Okay, tilt.
You know, I was fascinated also where you're really coming from is kind of like where Richard Maurice Buck is coming from, and we discussed that earlier, his book Cosmic Consciousness. It's an amazing parallels, whether you're his incarnation or not. Who knows for sure, but this was a progressive psychologist in the late 1800s up in Canada, not far from you. And,
He had spent quite a bit of time in California as well. So, you know, he's a North American by definition. He belongs to all of us. And then he came back to Ontario at that point. And he's a renowned figure in London, Ontario, which is where he was based in the final years of his life. And he ran the, they called them insane asylums then, but he was in charge of that. And I from what I can detect, he was obviously a very, very compassionate man, a contemporary and good friend of Walt Whitman, no less.
And it's interesting.
So his book, interesting connections, yes.
But his book on cosmic consciousness, I remember reading about it in the Whole Earth Catalog in the mid-70s, and I got it. And that was, to me, that book was, again, one of my kind of opus definitive, you know, guidebooks to this whole subject of what I call cosmic love today.
Let me show you what I see as the parallels, Christopher. Richard Maurice Buck, who some people think I'm the reincarnation of, and sometimes I think it myself, but at any rate...
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows for sure. What he did in his book, Cosmic Consciousness, is through an investigation of available literature and notes and details on the lives of Jesus Christ, Sir Francis Bacon, and several others, what he did is what we would call today a phenomenological study, studying the themes, the recurring themes, the patterns inside these what would be called eminent people's lives. And I did the same thing. I did a similar thing, not the same thing. I did a phenomenological study using a methodology, a psychological methodology, born of and developed in Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. And it's a methodology of sifting through the information, or let's say usually biographical or autobiographical information, to find those common denominators that make certain people and their let's call them life-changing experiences, which every one of them had, it shows us the common denominators, and those common denominators as themes rather than as abstract numbers, which really don't help people when they're trying to figure out who they are. That's why I'm sure you like these archetypes, because they're descriptive.
They're themes. They're thematic.
They have a feeling. They live as opposed to numbers don't.
Yeah.
And numbers are fine for rocks and plants and other things, but they're not really good for describing or helping people understand what they're going through at an emotional level. So the parallel is, we did a similar kind of study. He did a much bigger, let's call it a bigger sweep in terms of the personages of history is what he did, and I don't know what information he sifted through to come out with his cosmic consciousness. But cosmic consciousness, from my point of view, is now conscious evolution.
Conscious evolution, yeah.
Conscious evolution is what it is.
And your work on this, going back to your PhD. What was it? Your doctoral thesis?
Yeah,
on,
my thesis. Yeah.
On the hero with a thousand faces is actually the same phenomenological themes.
It is. Yeah. What I was struck by, Chris, and when I was doing my undergraduate work, my last few courses as an undergraduate were courses in the classics, and they were mythology based. And somehow I intuited that the hero myth. And I could relate it back to movies like some of those Hercules movies or Jason and the Argonauts movies, those kinds of heroic stories where a person is cast into a situation that forces them to confront personal issues, or in the case of Hercules, he had to fight these mythical seven-headed hydras and all of that stuff. But really, those are just illustrations of the greatest battles are all inner battles. We're all, our ego is trying to block us from finding our spiritual yourself, because when we do, the ego loses his job. He gets demoted.
He loses his job. Well, one of my favorite stories, like in that regard, is the story of the reluctant prophet Jonah at Nineveh.
Oh, yeah.
No, that's another classic. But you can actually get into anyone on the series on the spiritual path, mystic saints, shamans. I mean, they're really these masks that we wear, and the removing of the mask, to get to the, you might say, the same archetypal patterns. That are beyond the surface. To me, it's fascinating, and I've as yourself have been looking to tools and processes that help self awareness, self discovery, or otherwise discovering what's going on with one's own conscious processes. And that's why I referenced the spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical. Whether you call it fire, or water, and earth, or these four archetypal frames that really grabbed me when I read Jung. He spoke about it in a very general way, but I guess he had his four proteges actually write the four sections of the book, Man and His Symbols, that represented those four archetypes. Because we all have, and with the understanding of Jung and the pattern recognition that goes with self-discovery, that we all have a major and a minor way of approaching, and your minor is never the opposite one; it's one of the adjacent ones, and it can be, it can be any one of the four, and we all tend to be that. Some approach it all, you might say, through their feelings; some more through their mind; some more, are more intuitive oriented, and this thing of how we approach a reality, and perception is reality, and we're all wired differently in that regard. And I wanted to ask you about this. I was thought for a long time. I've had three holistic health centers over the years, and I really got into it very early on in the game, the understanding of metabolic typing. That there's so many, for example, diet programs out there that basically say this diet is for everyone, but it's really only for one metabolic type or another.
Yeah.
And it works great for some people and not others, but they push it for all people. And this is a common with healthcare, that healthcare is not based on biological individuality on your metabolic type, and psychologically, we see the same thing. There's a lot of psychology programs out there that aren't based on psychological individuality. They're like lowest common denominator, one BS belief system fits all.
The only tool you got is a hammer. Everything looks like a nail.
A nail. Everyone looks like a nail, and you hammer them until they get
exactly.
the message.
let me lay out a little bit more of where I come from. You're definitely, I'll just describe what I sense about you is that you're more on the intellectual side and the philosophical side, and you have a great breadth of experience and reading behind you as I listen to you talk. I'm going to say that my approach is...
more of the heart.
It's absolutely of the heart. It's all about feeling, and what I just didn't want to say is that one is better than the other. It's not the case, but
it's just different.
It is for me. It's all about the heart, and I appreciate and understand that the heart can run off if it's not governed, if it's not second guessed or challenged by some intellectual review process. But what I know and what I've saw in my practice days, Christopher, is that let's just start with men. North American men are very reserved and repressed, and white North American men are the most reserved and repressed.
Mental cases, and rather than emotional cases.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, the more left brain.
Well, what these folks are trying to do, I mean, it's so if you need to cast me somewhere, I'm sort of a rebel against the whole intellectual thing.
Uh-huh.
But you don't get through university without exercising some,
that's right,
some intellectual prowess. But what I use it for was to really understand from today's perspective, from today's what we know of psychology, of man's psychology. I wanted to use that mirror, that light, not that mirror, that light, to look at us today. As much I can talk about mythology, and I can talk about, let's say, the prodigal son story. That's the myth of the hero. There's a separation from a source. There's an initiation, which is experiences in some form or another, life's challenges, and then there's a return. And those are the three phases of the master myth. Which Joseph Campbell called the master myth is the myth of the hero. So, in terms of, let's say, our population, our world today, we are on the return trip. And some of us are going kicking and screaming, hanging on to the old ways, and some of us, like you and I, are reaching for it, and it can't get here fast enough. And then there's other people in between one extreme and the other who are flirting with it, but not quite sure they're ready to grab on yet. But
the more things speed up, the more wailing and gnashing of teeth.
Yeah. And the thing is, back to this repression thing, just to put a little finer point on it and just to make it a backbone of who I am, healing our emotional life is critical to advancing. It's absolutely critical, and we cannot intellectualize or rationalize what is an emotional wound. An emotional wound of any kind has to be expressed, either to a therapist, a good friend, or, absent those, put it in a journal. And that's what I preach. Emotional expression, it's like good psychology is an emotional enema, and it'll help you get that stuff out. And you get that stuff out, there's more room for light in your life. There's more room to receive God's love and to actually begin to believe and feel that you're worthy of it. Because you can tell people they're loved. You can hammer them with their love. But if they don't feel it, it doesn't exist.
That's
like you
true.
Say, reality is perception.
That's true. Well, my understanding is that we think an image is and symbols left brain of associative feelings, a right brain. You can't really separate them. And that men tend to feel with their mind, left brain dominant, and women tend to think with their feelings, their right brain dominant.
Yeah.
They're always connected, but when you talk about the repressed emotional feeling sensitivity of white, I refer to them stupid white men as where the Indians refer to them. the left brain dominant in orbit, and the point is, the strength in excess is a weakness in either hemisphere of the brain. And there's this new understanding of this left brain, right brain, left brain dominant, right brain dominant, and then the balanced left and right brain. And of course, what we're all tend to be moving to, as I understand it, in civilization right now, global civilization, is east meets west. The left hemisphere, the western left hemisphere meeting the right hemisphere, the eastern hemisphere, which has been inscrutable to the western mind, and it's all going from linear left brain to spherical nonlinear right brain consciousness. And what's happening, it's the judgment on all that lockstep linear left brain letter of the law, which killeth the spirit of the law. And it's interesting.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, and it's happening very quickly because we've got this instant everywhere interactive internet phenomena where there is no time or space anymore. It's like all the mysteries of time and space and knowledge, power, everything that's ever happened is all out there at your Google fingertips.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
There is a lot available to all of us, and that's why one of the big words of now, of the current time, is discernment.
Discernment.
You really have to discern, which means do an emotional analysis and a mental or intellectual analysis of anything that you're considering to have meaning for you. But without the emotional part, then you don't get to feel that click in your stomach that would, in a lot of cases, with intuitive people, they rely on that first, then they check in with their intellect. Intellectual people block that almost immediately, and then maybe let a little bit of it seep through. So a balance between East and West, that's one way of looking at it. A balance between men and women.
Left brain, right brain, men and women, East and West. And that's kind of the a horizontal relationship.
Sure.
The vertical relationship is like heaven and earth going on in our upper brain and our lower brain, whereas the left brain and right brain is more of a horizontal relationship. And that understanding of the upper brain and the lower brain, you know, the crown chakra, the upper brain, mm-hmm. the higher energies, and the base of the brain, which is the reptilian brain, the R complex. It's an interesting thing because there's intuition at the top and there's instinct at the bottom.
Yeah.
And one is super conscious and the one is unconscious. And then you have conscious in between with this left brain, right brain thing going on. And it's really interesting because the concept of the upper brain and lower brain is like the concept of a person with his head in the clouds and the person with his feet on the ground. You know, the farmer, the old clodbuster expression was that he didn't get the best ideas, but he followed through with them, whereas the person with his head in the cloud got these great ideas, but he wasn't down to earth with them.
Yeah. Those are like bookends almost. They're the extremes. The healthy position, you know, and I can't
it's right
help.
It's in the center, yeah.
Well,
the capstone.
The way these things work themselves out for me is that our feeling nature is essential to not just understand, but to just to be open to and allow to flow through us. It's more important now, not because it's more important, but because it's been absent from the grid for a long time. It's not been allowed to flow, and it has to flow for the balance to come together. And it is flowing.
It is
the difference between Second World War veterans and Vietnam War veterans is that the Vietnam War veterans gave rise to the understanding of that crisis, the stress syndrome, post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the guys from the Second World War didn't talk about their war experiences and the horror, but they drank and they gathered at, various clubs. They did so here in Canada, and I'm sure they did so in the United States.
Yep, VFW.
The Vietnam War veterans were caught between. They were harmed by the fact that there was no understanding of post-traumatic stress, and post-traumatic stress is emotion-based. And so the post-traumatic stress, that is the need to get these horrible, sick, scary feelings out into the open, you know, to share them in order to remove them, in order to let them go. Whenever you see someone in a movie coming to a crisis point and breaking down into tears, that's good news because it's a release. It represents a release. Well, that release couldn't happen for these guys until permission. Permission came with the understanding of a psychology and not any more of this button-your-bottom-lip thing and just take it, which is, very British, right? Stiff upper lip.
Uh-huh.
Well, now, and since the 80s, with the advent of these people like John Bradshaw and Melody Beattie, who've been writing in the area of the recovery movement, that is, dealing with major addictions like alcohol and drugs and such, and the big word, the big phrase, codependence, came into our jargon, and dysfunctional families. All of these things have become doorways and avenues for people to talk about their feelings. And then as feelings get talked about and an inventory of hurt feelings in particular is reduced to a manageable level, and along with that experience, people garner the tools to continue to do that, which is why I taught everybody to journal, because you can take that tool with you anywhere. Then the emotional stress or the stress resulting from emotional repression is diminished, and you're not making reactive decisions or choices in your life. You're making informed decisions. And that's only step one. Step two, three, four, and five is you're going to connect with your source, our source, through your feelings, through your heart, not through your head. You're going to feel that presence, and your head is going to identify it and say, uh-oh, That's, you know, the jackpot. That's the importance of feeling for where I come from. And feeling is linked directly to spirituality.
I always say that the heart of the mind of God is the frequency of holy compassion. And what I think the big phase that's been going on since 2000 is this quantum understanding of it. It's all a field of energy, and frequency and feeling is everything. It's everything.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It's all frequency. It's all, you know, it's all energy. And it's like movies like What the Bleep Do We Know, which gets into this quantum field and how it's all connected. And consciousness is a frequency. It's, you know, and this concept of the frequency of love, as in frequently, you know, you know, that concept of that is, that's the heart of the mind of God. I mean, you can frame it, but the framing isn't the frequency.
It's, you know, there's a lot of good concepts and language in my field, psychological theories, to help you understand personal dynamics, human dynamics, you know, what growth is, what our spiritual life is. And they're all as good as the person or persons who lay them out, and they're only as good as the best possible roadmap you can get. But they are never a substitute for actual living those experiences.
Right.
They are a guide to those experiences. When you're on a trip and you're looking at the travel manual, you do not keep your nose in the travel manual when you arrive or are close to your new destination. You look out the windows. You experience the new destination. The guidebook is just a helper. It's an aid. It stands in the background of the experience. The experience of love is the most powerful experience we can have. The experience of fear is almost equally powerful, but love washes over everything. And
yeah.
Love is not the syrupy love of daytime soap operas. Love is the actual juice that comes from source. Ergo, another good reason to be connected at the feeling level, because that is ecstasy, as good as any orgasm you've ever had.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, that energy of connection is talk about codependent addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, there's no substitute for it. I think most of our life is trying to get back to that one way or the other. How do you find our way home?
That is it. That is it. Where we are. We are going home. Home is where the heart is. I end a lot of my articles with that phrase. Home is where the heart is. Remember. And I like the story of the prodigal son, because it's a biblical representation of the hero myth. We've gone, you know, let's just consider hypothetically. I believe this to be true, but just consider it hypothetically for your folks and even yourself. I'm a firm believer that Atlantis existed, and that some of us, including you and I, lived there and bathed in exquisiteness.
And I wanted to talk about this, so I'm glad you're coming to this.
Yeah, it was the Garden of Eden, in the sense that we were at one with Source.
Yep.
We could see the cherubim and angels and all the gods, goddesses, and archangels. We interacted with them. There was no competition. There was cooperation, and there was a beautiful appreciation of our interdependence and our foundation as all coming from the same root source. Then the experiment began with the dark side, which is the separation, also called the secret separation. It's in music, it's in books, it's in all kinds of things. And so it brought to mind, like, if one were to really understand, fully understand the beauty and the importance and the value and the hominess of connection, then one might want to learn that by living through its opposite, which is disconnection, which has been the story of man for the last few thousand years, 12,000, give or take. And now we've had enough of it. We want to go home.
The expression is, if all you know is the light, you take the light for granted, which is why we take physical incarnation, this dense octave of of 3D is because, yeah, you know, when you're in the light, they say you have actually, I've read that you know, as much as seven times the opportunity for spiritual growth when you have something to work against. And in the light, in the etheric octaves, there's nothing to work against. And apparently, back at the time of Atlantis, in physical incarnation, there was that oneness with Source, and people took it for granted and started playing around with the dark side.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And you have a website called AtlantisRisingSpirit.com.
Yeah.
And I wanted to mention that. You have several other websites. But specifically, this subject to me and your whole dealing with this core psychological PTSD trauma, dealing with the sense of separation and suffering from abandonment, from the sense of separation from Source. This subject that you deal with in your YouTube videos and your other writings, really, as I thought about this, at reading and listening to your videos, AtlantisRisingSpirit.com, the publisher of Atlantis Rising magazine here is right here in Livingston, Montana, and I've been reading that from the time it came out. I've got a whole, you know, stack of it for years, and I know the publisher of it, and that whole subject of how the real story of Hapgood's theory of Atlantis and how it didn't really sink, but there was crustal displacement of the Earth and all that stuff. I have followed that for years with the understanding of, I mean, I read books about Atlantis, as you were talking about, Philos the Tibetan. Are you familiar with that one?
No, the one I read was, I forget his name, you might know it, but it was called Atlantis, the Antediluvian State, and it was written in the 1800s. I don't know if he was a British writer. I can't think. If I Googled it, I'd find it.
It sounds like a parallel to the Philos the Tibetan, which was pretty much channeled material back from that time.
Yeah.
Also, you know, and
well, who wrote more about Atlantis before the last 200 years than Plato?
There you go.
In the Timaeus and the Critias, he wrote about it like he was just laying out a history book based on information available at that time.
And I think his flickering on the wall was referring to flat projection screens, TVs. You know, the cave wall, the flickering of images on the wall. I think that was the only way he could put it was that they had TVs back then also. But the whole subject of civilizations like individuals are condemned to repeat their mistakes until they learn from them.
Yes.
And that's this whole thing of how we recreate the traumas of the past in the present, one way or the other, consciously or subconsciously, or, you know, and that this is the big, you know, this is the test that's best. This is why we come into embodiment. This is, this is, you know, the whole purpose of eternal progression in the realms of the spirit matter dance.
Right.
I'm just fascinated with it, and you're dealing with this subject of the healing of that record of the whole record.
What these series of articles is about is really, it's about identifying, we'll call it a pretty blissful state, certainly absent all the negativity that we're dealing with today. The frightening parallel, before I'll get back to the Atlantis site in a minute, but the frightening parallel at the very present moment is that, from my perspective, the Western world is at the same brink, on the same precipice as the leaders of the dark back at the final phase of Atlantis when it sunk beneath the waves. Like
the parallels,
the
are
craziness
uncanny.
Of greed, the craziness of the financial markets, the absence of a conscience. I think that's a word that comes up in your material a lot. The absence of a conscience, therefore compassion, the absence of emotion from one's life allows people to profit on other people's
misery. On the misery of others.
And but this, not just others, their own.
their own misery.
The profiteers in North America are the banking institutions and the big families that were behind the nonsense that went on Wall Street, which just ricocheted around the world to show the fragility and the cracks in the whole Western style of our financial system. And we're not out of that. And that's not repairing itself like people hope.
No.
It's not doing that.
The only way we'll heal the economics of scarcity is with a conscience of abundance, or abundant conscience.
Yes. Well, I agree. I agree with that. And it seems like, you know, if let's say a certain experiences or certain, call them frequencies or fluctuations, keep accelerating and accelerating, at some point there has to be an explosion. There has to be an implosion. Something has to happen.
There is so much cognitive dissonance.
Yes.
And dis-ease.
Yes.
And there's no cure for depression when it's the sense of, you know, there's no cure with a drug for depression that's caused from a disconnect from spirit.
Right.
And.
Right.
And what we're seeing with mass depression in the public is that as the veil thins and there's like instant judgment on all that's less than light, all that's, you know, when I say instant judgment, people, as the veil thins, and I really believe this is the real dynamic going on in 2011 through 2012, and probably, you know, I mean, the when I say the veil is thinning, this quantum field of energy is in resonance on an atomic level, a DNA level, which are like tuning forks, with really the heart of our galaxy, the great central sun of our galaxy, in alignment with billions of star systems in this sombrero-like galaxy, which is our Milky Way. If you look at it from the side in space, it's a big plane, the galactic plane of these billions of star systems in like a frisbee around this great central sun. And our solar system's now orbiting up between that, and it's in alignment with this photonic energy. And our atoms, our cells, electrons, our whole DNA tuning fork is just like resonating with, basically, when I say the quantum frequency of the heart of holy compassion, mind of God, however you put it, conscious evolution is getting a reboot, and this is the thinning of the veil. I understand it, and because of that, we've got all that's less than light, all that's less than harmony, all that's less than beauty and order, and you know, the divine order, divine harmony. All that's less than that is becoming self-evident in terms that's freaking depressing.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are just depressed, and they're going through motions, and they're just kind of got a weight on them, and it's hard to put the finger on it, because obviously so many of our social, political, and economic institutions no longer serve the purpose for which they were created, and we're facing a disintegration spiral right now, and a dis-ease. The dis-ease and depression is this disintegration of the old, and we haven't really, it's not, the collective consciousness hasn't all agreed on a definitive Holy Spirit love and action solution yet.
Well, that's why conscious evolution speaks to the individual obligation of every one of us to step into that field.
Yeah.
We're not we're past the point of being dragged along and, you know, bumping off the sides of this life of ours like we're, you know, a pinball flying up and down the floor of the machine. Conscious evolution is, I take responsibility for my life, and I choose to evolve. And I choose to evolve because I feel drawn to it. It compels me. It feels right to me. I feel it in my heart, and it's home. And I want to go home. And home is the fifth dimension, no veil, no competition, none of the BS that we've got going on today. Home is where we were when we were in Atlantis phases one, phase one. We were at one with everything. And now we know that not being at one and being disconnected sucks. Basically, it sucks. So going home, reunited, being one with the Father is a necessity. And that's what my two articles so far on abandonment are about. If you've experienced abandonment in your life, and some of us, many of us perhaps have as children, and I talk about my own abandonment issues in the first of those two articles, but I think the fundamental rift in our hearts is abandonment trauma. And we're still under the illusion, the delusion, or the mistake that God abandoned us. We still haven't quite grasped that we left home. We left home, ergo prodigal son. We left home. But conscious evolution means, like anything you think you may have done wrong or any mistakes, you have to own it before you can forgive it.
Yeah.
You can't rationalize it anymore. You can't distract yourself from it anymore, or you're going to have to use more booze, more drugs, or you're going to have to work harder, and that's just another addiction, you know, workaholism.
Yeah.
And which gave rise to stress and people and burnout. And that was a book, a big book, an important book in the 80s. Burnout.
Yeah.
That's what that is. So where we are naturally inclined, and if we do any, just a little bit of reading about it, you don't have to become a savant to get a sense of this, but you really, really do have to trust your feelings.
Yeah.
If you can't trust your feelings, which is essentially trusting yourself, and a lot of us were taught not to trust ourselves. We were taught to trust the church, the external authorities, the education system, the government. We were turned away from ourselves, and we're looking for meaning in our life outside of ourselves in the world of matter, which is really only a projection of where we're at emotionally. As soon as we retrieve that and turn it around, then we really do understand that life is lived from the inside out. And what is outside of us but a projection of something inside? And if it sucks outside of you, then you got something inside that needs attention.
Yeah.
That's been my experience. And every time I've come to a wall like this, and I have recently, I've had to face something that I didn't really like. And I had to accept it. And I had to forgive myself.
How to get back to that inner sense, which is the heart of innocence, you know, true innocence with that inner sense of not just I'm okay and you're okay, but really there is that principle that if you're not okay with yourself, if you don't really love yourself, you can't give to others what you don't have for yourself. And, of course, all relationship trauma comes back to that same sense of separation from, you know, that I... And it's a difficult thing, but it's a simple thing. And this is where the paradox is. I mean, there is a point where when a person mediates or meditates and becomes one with that sense of it's all good, and being able to look at everyone without judgment, but really look at everyone and be able to say everyone's 100% right for their prevailing awareness. Even if they're out to, you know what I mean?
Put that on a T-shirt.
Even if they may be out to lunch as far as cosmic law goes.
Yeah.
You know, there is this thing of attunement, you know, and it's sometimes called discernment. But there's an attunement with the mantle of mastery that the ascended masters graduated with, you know. The ones that don't have to incarnate here again, they can if they're bodhisattvas and they keep wanting to coming back to help people. But the momentum of mastery that is really the path of the ascension, you know, once you graduate, you can work from the other side of the veil and overshadow people with your momentum of mastery, you know, your mantle of energy, your mantle of mastery, and you can lower that over people and help them because they're praying for it and really are pure in heart and deserve it.
Yeah.
And there is that attunement that you can pull that down with just a pure heart, you know, that inner sense that has that innocence that just, that has this, the innocence of love, you know, that just, and there's an attunement, which I think that's the purpose of meditation, some kind of mediation with that, that the master's mantle of divine love, just momentum of pure energy. I mean, there are beings, there are angels. You know, we know that. And so I've really got into books like Dr. David Hawkins on The Power versus Force, where he says that one individual who lives and vibrates to the energy of pure love and reverence for all of life will counterbalance the negativity of 750,000 individuals who calibrate at the lower weakening levels. Now, this is based on behavioral kinesiology, you know. That book he did on Power versus Force, they did over like 10 years, they did about a study of about a million people using this behavioral kinesiology, but not everyone can use that technique. But I know individuals that really could, and he worked with individuals that could, and they had this research project for 10 years, and they found all these levels and these determinants of again, with this using a testing method that I've known many people who were masters at that for healing, you know, body, mind, spirit, you know, as a testing method. But the concept that just by raising yourself up and being attuned individually, you can raise the frequency of hundreds of thousands of individuals who are at a lower level. This is, I think, what's going on in 2011 and picking up steam from the inside out. You know, this God force, God consciousness in our galaxy, you know, billions of star systems, there's an intelligence in that light, and that light's just rebooting our atom cells, electrons, our DNA, and I'm hopeful.
If we're open, Christopher, and the thing is, we don't have to literally, you know, in some mechanical fashion, pick ourselves up by the bootstraps. What we got to do is be clear and align ourselves with the energies that are here and available to us now. And that's a different form of conscious evolution. It's not about you know, picking things off a shelf. It's about choosing, you know, attunement. I like that. Fine-tuning our spiritual alignment with the forces that are there for our own best good.
For uplifting, growth, and love.
All we got to do is put the canoe in the river and go down the river. Keep it straight. That's all we have to do.
Yeah.
We don't even have to paddle. All we got to do is be in the river and go straight.
The stream of consciousness, and just go with the flow, bro.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things growing up was doing the sing-alongs with my dad in the car and six kids, you know, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. The stream of consciousness is from moment to moment as we become conscious of how we're conscious. It's like the principle of biofeedback. You know, once you become conscious of that which was unconscious and involuntary, not only do you will to control, you can't resist self-control. Well, that's what psyche feedback is. As this energy accelerates and you become conscious of how you're conscious in the stream of consciousness, moment to moment, it's like you self-correct. There's a self-correction, and when there's not the frequency of love, you go, uh-oh, that's not right. You know? And I really think it comes down to that frequency, the standard, that small voice within becomes that resonant frequency of harmony and order. And there's no separation. It's like left and right brain. It's like form and function, or form and frequency. There's the left brain linear frames of reference, but there's the right brain intuitive feeling, you know, the spirit that, and when you have harmony and order in the left and right brain as that small voice within, in a horizontal relationship with other people and with yourself, you self-correct. You naturally self-correct.
Chris, you hit the nail on the head. Is the inner voice within?
Yeah,
that is the common denominator between the four people that I studied to write my project on. Personal transformation is what I wrote about, and I didn't have a big spiritual event then, but I was drawing heavily on the myth of the hero. And that is the same central act, central component in
ascension journaling. Ascension. Journaling for ascension.
I'm making a parallel between myself and Richard Maurice Buck and the book Cosmic Consciousness.
Oh, yeah.
Now I'm not going to claim to have invented that phrase. I found that phrase, as I think is the case for most people. And artists throughout history have given us that phrase, or some artists, you know, it's what used to be called the muse. But as the governing center of your life and your personality, the inner voice, which is your deepest self, your cosmic self, your spiritual self, your higher self. It's the informer and guide in your life, and you can't hear that or feel that if you're disconnected with your feelings. You need to feel that, and I guess you can feel it intellectually as well as you can feel it emotionally, because you certainly need your intellect to describe the images that your emotions are receiving. But that's the key, and that's what it takes us back to source. So there's a thousand million ways to say it, but that's the key. Our own very center is our center, is our connection to source.
Theologically, they've always referenced, you know, you go to the Father through the Son, and what it's really saying, you go to God through your higher Christ self, your real self, your true self, your work with conscious journaling, or you know, journaling
yes,
for ascension.
Yeah, yeah.
Your the idea of creating, you know, a way of out picturing and in self-evident, you know, writings in the journaling process, how you're conscious, so you can become more conscious of how you're conscious, and then direct that flow.
And you can talk to different parts of yourself. You can give them names and not be considered a whack job. It's not something you're going to go out and share in public. But, you know, you've got your scared self. You've got your angry self. You've got your mystical self. You've got your higher self. As you use the pages in a journal to dialogue back and forth, let's say, you know, you're aware of a very powerful agitation in your stomach. This is regular for me. I just go to my book. What am I feeling? And then that part of me, and lately it's been scared, it's been fearful, and it's all about, it's what it's all about. It's kind of like what I went through when I was a teenager, and my body was changing so fast I couldn't keep up with it. What I'm going through now, and what many of us are going through now, is this conscious spiritual evolutionary change that just by putting ourselves in the right, you know, the right part of the river where we're going to flow downstream, it's moving at a hell of a clip, and it takes immediate adjusting. So that for me, my journal has become like it's my right arm right now, because I have to keep dialoguing with myself to bring to my conscious mind what it is that's happening to me. And as soon as I do that, the emotional side calms down.
Yeah.
The emotional side calms down. Okay, this agitation isn't bad. This agitation, wow, in fact, this agitation is like, I had a breakthrough today. I had an epiphany, an awareness. Something hit me, an aha experience. Call it what you like. And they're going to be happening. They're already happening a lot right now. But it's like, it's just, that's accelerating too. Till we are fully engaged with the fifth dimension, which is where we came from, which means our 12 strands of DNA will be reconnected, and there'll be more added later, but we're down to two right now, and the other 10 are allegedly junk DNA. They're not. They were disconnected because
they're
we lost
disconnected.
Connection.
That's right.
That's all.
I think the big process, the big step, I think so many people are really stretching right now to, in a sense, speed up so that the rate of accelerating change will slow down. I mean, it's like it's all relative, but there is a thing with if the only place to go at this stage is up in frequency.
Yes.
No, there's the only place to go, and it's the only salvation, you might say, is to somehow raise that frequency, and that requires working on all levels, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and physically.
Yes.
And,
oh, yes.
And this process of psyche feedback, you know, becoming conscious of how we're conscious, it's not just stepping out of ourselves for a third-person perspective. It's more like stepping into our real self. And you're going within and somehow centering and connecting with that I call it assembling the components of the capstone, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and physically. They're the four sides. And that the fifth dimension really is that sense of how it is all connected. And somehow going beyond the sense of separation of all of them in a synergy that's greater than the sum of the parts. And, you know, this is all metaphor, but, you know, that's, I guess, the only way to really approach the spirit that matters in this dense octave of incarnation is exquisite myth or metaphor.
There's one other very, very important component. When we're on the path and consciously choosing to be on the path, we are to be made aware of the fact that we're moving from a crystalline-based physical body to a silicone. I'm sorry.
From a carbon-based to a
carbon-based body to a crystalline-based body, because our carbon-based bodies cannot handle the incoming energies. And so part of our ascension is not just an intellectual and emotional thing. There is a physical component. And we'll have to talk about this more at another time. But there is a series of commands coming to us from the ethereal side. And one of them is called the rejuvenation command. And those on the path, and I know this is wild and way out there, and who knows, you know, how wacky people will think I am now. But people back in Atlantis and pre-Noah times lived 700-800 years, and that was a fact. And they, as much as they've tried to cook the books since then, it was still a fact. And what they lived in,
yeah,
and what's going to be available to us is a transformation to a crystalline state in which we can stay on the planet for as long as we want, certainly hundreds of years.
Well, we're going to have to finish on that note. We're going to have to do a wrap. Our time is up. But Dr.
Sure.
Mo, I am so grateful for your time, and we're going to have to do this again, and I'll definitely
Absolutely.
Be in touch. And
okay.
I want to thank everyone for listening, and happy trails until we meet again. See you next couple of weeks. Bye-bye.